I think if everyone is settled, I wonder perhaps if we could begin. And it gives me very great pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Institute of Criminology to the 17th Bill McWilliams Memorial Lecture. The Institute has had long-standing and indeed continuing interest in probation and community sanctions more generally, and so it's a particular delight to host this lecture. It's amazing that the lectures have continued into their 17th year from what began as a five-year initiative started by some of Bill's colleagues, Brenda, his wife and his family, whom we particularly welcome today. The lecture, in its early days, moved around from institution to institution, but in 2008, the Institute agreed to host the lecture for a further 5 years. I should immediately say that the Institute is very happy to host the lectures for as long as they continue. We are developing probation interests all the time in the Institute of Criminology. We're very pleased to be hosting the NAPO archives, and one or two probation trusts have also deposited their archives within the Institute. So we hope that the lectures will continue for a good while longer. In connection with this, we'd welcome your views, and I think on the registration desk, I think you were given a questionnaire, and we very much appreciate your completing that questionnaire so that we can think how best to continue the lectures. Well, Bill McWilliams had a prestigious career as a probation practitioner, researcher and writer, and he was a staunch advocate of the need for rigorous evaluation of probation practice and an equally staunch critic of the excesses of the management ideal. The memorial lectures began as an attempt to keep alive his critical spirit. Given that probation as we've known it is presently undergoing major restructuring and redirection to some extent, the lectures may also seem to be about keeping alive the spirit of probation. And who better to keep that spirit alive this year is Sue Hall. Sue Hall first qualified as a probation officer in 1979 with a first job in Humberside in Grimsby, I believe. Sue then moved to West Yorkshire, then on to South Wales, and then back to West Yorkshire in 2005, where until the end of July 2014, she is chief executive of the Trust. And I think it's important to say, and I know that many here know this, that Sue has been passionate about probation throughout, committed to raising the profile of probation both nationally and internationally, probation as a profession. And Sue received an OBE for services to probation in 2010. Now, Sue is a transitional director of the newly launched Independent Probation Institute, which aims to develop a strong probation profession across the public, voluntary and private sectors and to become a centre of excellence. And I, for one, am very pleased that Sue has honoured us in this way by coming to speak and to share something of her passion. Now, we'll proceed with Sue's lecture in just one moment, but let me also say that immediately after the lecture, there'll be a panel to lead off the questions and discussion, and we hope that there will be lots of questions and discussion. And that panel will be chaired by my colleague, Professor Mike Nellis, one of the founder members of the Bill McWilliams Memorial Lecture Steering Group. So over to Mike at that point. But without further ado, let us please welcome Sue to give the 17th Bill McWilliams Memorial Lecture.
Lorraine, and I can assure you that the honour is all mine. It really is a huge privilege to have been asked here today to give the 17th Bill McWilliams Lecture. It's like a terrifying prospect, but nevertheless a huge honour. I never personally had the privilege of hearing Bill McWilliams speak or meeting him, but as I've been preparing for today, I have become, if I wasn't aware already, I've become acutely aware of the huge legacy he's left, and in particular the four seminal papers that he wrote between 83 and 87, which set a framework for making sense of the ideas influencing probation practice and which still provide a touchstone for us today. On a personal level, it's also very significant for me to be here today in Cambridge. I did my first degree here, I did my degree here in Cambridge, and I still have really vivid memories, as I was boring Rob Canton with a bit earlier, really vivid memories of the first time that I came on the Sidgwick site to have my first lecture in German literature, being really awe-inspired to be here on the campus and a bit nervous, but very excited at the prospect. And coming back here today just really brings those feelings back to me. I can still remember standing in front of the lecture hall and going in, and never, I suppose, would I have imagined that 40 years later I would have been back here to give a lecture myself. At that point, I doubt that I'd ever heard of probation or had any idea what it did, but within 3 years of graduating, I'd thrown aside the prospect of being a bilingual secretary and was training as a probation officer in Cardiff. It's a matter of some amazement to me that I was ever allowed on the course, because compared to today's candidates for the PQF, I had a woefully thin curriculum vitae. But they took a chance on me, and in those days the CQSW courses were enormous compared to today's intake. I think it was 100 a year at Cardiff. So I had a really excellent opportunity to make my entrance into probation. I qualified and ended up as a probation officer, as Lorraine has said, in the Grimsby Probation Officer. And I became what Anne Worrell and Rob Morby in their book Doing Probation Work call a lifer. Someone for whom probation has been a vocation, a lifelong commitment, and their main career. And that leads me to the second reason why coming here today is really significant for me. If the first is about the place, then the second is about timing. It's just over 2 weeks since the West Yorkshire Probation Trust's contract with NOMS was terminated, and to use MOJ terminology, the new National Probation Service and the West Yorkshire Community Rehabilitation Company were stood up. The trust still exists on paper, but it only has two employees, me and the chair, and the entire budget are our salaries. We'll be there till the 31st of July together with the other board members. So it's a slightly surreal experience for those chiefs, and there are a few of us in the audience here today, those chiefs who are in this sort of limbo position. But as I prepare to move out of a lifetime in probation, it's a good opportunity to reflect. I wanted to call the lecture Why Probation Matters, because I wanted to think about what's important, what's actually the essence of probation, what's important, what's endured, and actually what do we want to sustain through the rather turbulent changes that we're facing at the moment. So I'm going to roam about a bit in the lecture, I hope you'll indulge me on that, but I do want to try and reflect on where probation is and the profession, the place potentially that the Probation Institute can play in sustaining a profession into the future. In 1969, Joan King in the Probation and Aftercare Service said, "The great contribution of the Probation Service has been to the humanisation of justice. Probation's roots, as we all know, came from humanistic endeavours to find an alternative to prison and to a purely punitive response to crime." It's worth reminding ourselves that in many countries in the world today, where there is no developed probation service and where prison remains the main response to crime, you see scenes like this. This is a photograph of prison conditions in Brazil, and it was published by, of all papers, the Daily Mail last week, as a sort of warning to football fans going off to the World Cup to behave themselves. But in fact, a very interesting series of photos were produced that you can see online in the Daily Mail. Shocking photos of men crammed into large sort of holding pens, sleeping five to a cell, you know, crammed into windows, sitting with their legs dangling out of the windows. In conditions such as these, violence and disease flourish. No help, no hope. And these scenes are by no means unique to Brazil. All over the globe, you'll find countries with prison conditions equally shocking, equally difficult. It's therefore no surprise that the Council of Europe, which exists to promote human rights, is interested in probation and encourages those countries seeking to join the Council of Europe to consider a probation service. In 2010, it adopted a set of European probation rules, which, although sadly they're not particularly well known in England and Wales, are influential in other European jurisdictions. I think the first principle is quite interesting. It says, as you can read, probation agencies shall aim to reduce reoffending by establishing positive relationships with offenders in order to supervise, including control where necessary, guide and assist them, and promote their successful social inclusion. Probation thus contributes to community safety and the fair administration of justice. The emphasis on positive relations and on working with offenders, with the main purpose being to guide and assist in helping offenders return to and reintegrate into society, is very important. In answering the question about what's distinctive about probation, Rob Canton has said, other agencies, after all, are committed to public safety and reducing reoffending. What's distinctive about probation is its belief that this can best be effected through establishing positive relationships with people who have offended. Again, I think the word belief is very telling here and very important. It goes straight to the ethical heart of probation, a heart in which a strong culture of shared values has continued to exist. Mike Nellis, in an essay on Humanising Justice, the English Probation Service up to 1972, has described a humanistic sensibility rather than a fully shared knowledge base was mostly what unified the outlook of probation officers from the 1960s onwards. I think when we look back over the last 30 years, and I'm not going to be doing an awful lot of that, so much has changed from the journey from advice, assistance, befriend to enforcement, public protection and rehabilitation. Yet I would argue that an ethical core of recognisable values has remained. I think what strengthens since Mike Nellis wrote those comments is the knowledge base. I think that's been one of the great achievements of the last 10 to 15 years. An evidence base which I think is shared and accepted amongst probation staff about effective practice. Building on the optimism that probation could make a difference, which the What Works initiatives of the early 2000s generated, the more recent findings from Desistance Research and the Good Lives model have been enthusiastically embraced by staff, which I feel has led to a real upsurge in confidence about practice. One of the reasons, I think, why notions of desistance have proved so popular with probation staff, and I think they really have become embedded in the way staff think about their practice, is that they chime with the value base that Rob Canton has described. If you want some example of that, I think you need to go no further than looking at NAPO. In 2011, NAPO produced a professional practice book which came out of a resolution in their 2011 AGM. And interestingly, they say in the lead-up to the book, the origins of professional practice run far deeper than the work they've done from this book. Right through the history of NAPO and the probation service, and they say somewhat loftily, from the ideas of what is just and an optimism about what can be. I think it's very interesting that they put a very confident and optimistic spin on practice. And it's quite a long quote here, but I will just point out a few things that they say. They say, we aim to reaffirm probation values which can get blown about in the prevailing political wind. And interestingly, much of the information here in their professional handbook has been handed on from colleagues, be they practitioners, teachers, managers, and partnership workers, and our clients themselves. Napo don't like the word offender, so our clients themselves. There are currently some positive developments in probation work. Offender engagement affirms the importance of working relationships. Examining what influences desistance from crime is providing new directions in practice, and it looks possible that reciprocal learning might officially claim a space in the relationship between practitioner and client. How interesting that NAPO were writing this at exactly the same time as George Mayer and Lol Burke were talking about the service potentially having lost its roots, its tradition, its culture, its professionalism, and wondering whether the probation service really had a future. Interesting dichotomy, and it struck me quite forcibly as I've been stuck in the West Yorkshire Library reading up for today's lecture, just how often academics and commentators return to analyse probation's history again and again, and how much questioning there's been over the last decade about whether probation can survive. And generally, I have to say, pretty gloomy conclusions. If we just consider the last three lectures in this series and just what they called themselves, Peter Rayner in 2011 said, is probation still possible? And that was before transforming rehabilitation. Steve Collett, also pre-TR, whether the probation service and the concept of probation would survive in a form which is recognisable. Paul Senior last year called his lecture Death Knell of a Much Cherished Probation Service in the Face of Privatisation Threats. And I've mentioned Mayer and Burke's comments about the service potentially having lost its roots. I think Gwen Robinson and Fergus McNeill made an interesting comment when they said, when in the mid-1990s the government's hostility to the idea of social work with offenders led the Home Secretary to repeal the need for probation officers to hold a social work qualification, the service lost a claim to an identity defined outside government policy. The position's been exacerbated because historically there hasn't been an independent professional lead body which safeguards professional ethics and standards and oversees a licence to practice. This leaves probation officers in a very different position to social workers, teachers, doctors, lawyers. Not only is there no professional lead body, but the Home Office / Ministry of Justice have maintained an iron grip over the qualification, determining criteria for entry to the profession and the ways in which you can get there. This has left probation and the professional identity of its workers tied to government policy and therefore vulnerable because of the seemingly endless twists and turns over the last 12 years. And yet despite this, as the example from the NAPO handbook shows, a professional culture and a shared value base appear to have remained. And I think it's quite interesting that Rob Morby and Anne Worrell, in their interviews with about 60 staff, came to the conclusion that actually what's said at the top isn't always what happens at the shop front of an organisation. Probation workers are skilled at crafting their job in ways that allows them to meet the organisation's demands while maintaining their identity as honourable professions who make a difference. I think Lorraine Gelsthorpe said something similar, and I'm paraphrasing here, so forgive me, Lorraine, if I get it wrong, but something about staff managing to deal with the diktats from on high and interpreting them in a way that allowed them to practice in an ethical manner. Now, I don't expect too much of it, because clearly policy determines what we do, how often we do it, how it's monitored, and all of those sorts of things. But while McNeill and Robinson are right in one sense, there is no independent reference point for the profession which could sustain professional identity. It has to be acknowledged that the ethical base has continued. And I think the NAPO quote actually gets to the heart of it, where they talk about how the culture has been handed on from colleagues through practitioners, teachers, managers, partnership workers, and our clients themselves. However, that was written in the run-up to transforming rehabilitation, and it has to be acknowledged that what we're currently going through is of a different order of restructuring to the changes that have happened over the last decade. The outsourcing, the privatisation of the majority of probation work will have a long-standing consequence for the way probation is practised and the way professional identity develops. And so I want to take a little digression and just have a little look at transforming rehabilitation and start off by asking, why was it needed? Was the probation service so broken that it needed to be split up and rebuilt anew? I'd like to just take two random quotes from ministers on transforming rehabilitation, and actually they could have been one of any number of quotes, because what we've seen is there are actually a very small number of arguments that get recycled over and over again in press releases and in interviews. They're quotes and arguments that don't necessarily run in a logical way or lead to logical conclusions, but they are made in a way that has become a sort of mantra. And if I were a member of the public with no direct experience of probation, then I would probably think that somehow the probation service is the source of a lot of the criminal justice system's woes. So Justice Minister Jeremy Wright, in respect of the then planned NAPO strike last October, talked about the strike as being in favour of the status quo. Well, yes, they were keen to maintain a public probation service, and of high reoffending rates. I'm not quite sure how that follows. He added, more than 600,000 offences were committed last year by those who had broken the law before. Despite spending $4 billion a year on prisons and probation, the public deserves better, and we're committed to introducing our important reforms, which were widely consulted on. It'd be very interesting just to deconstruct that statement if one had enough time. Yes, 600,000 offences were committed by those who had broken the law before. By no means all of them were on probation. And as we all know, to desist from crime is a process. It doesn't happen overnight. I'll come on back to the high reoffending rates in just a moment. Chris Grayling in April said, and he was talking here about the Peterborough payment by results pilot, while the same old approach has seen reoffending rates barely change in a decade, these groundbreaking through-the-gate pilots with voluntary private and public sectors working together are getting results. The message is clear. Our reforms are the right approach and will help us end the depressing cycle of reoffending too many are caught up in, keeping our communities safer. It's slightly ironic that later in the same statement he went on to close down the PBR pilot in Peterborough. But the leap from reoffending rates haven't changed through to some fairly slender results coming out of Peterborough to an assertion that therefore our reforms are the right approach. What a massive leap that is to that conclusion. TR is based on three premises essentially. One is, we see it here, that reoffending rates are unacceptably and stubbornly high. We hear that phrase a lot, stubbornly high, and have barely changed over the last decade. That short-term adult prisoners, the most recidivist group of offenders in the system, need to be subject to statutory supervision on release, bringing an extra 50,000 cases into the system. And thirdly, that the only way to achieve this is by outsourcing the majority of probation work to the private sector and introducing a system of payment by results. Well, probation staff have had to put up with a lot over the last year, but actually one of the things that's upset them particularly is this assertion, this misrepresentation of the role that probation has had in reducing reoffending, implying that probation has had no impact because of these stubbornly high reoffending rates. It's true, if you look at the figures for all adults added together, then it has flatlined for the last 10 years at around 28% reoffending within a year. But that's adding in people on fines, short-term prisoners, long-term prisoners. If you segment if you look at segments of the offender population, then you see a very different story. And PCA has made the point on many times, but for the record, I do feel the need to make it again, that the record on community supervision and community orders has been a good one. These are the Ministry of Justice's most recent figures. It's their own figures showing proven reoffending. The longer blue line is court orders, that's community orders and suspended sentence orders. The red line are community orders. And what we see with the community orders is that if you go from the high in 2003, where 39.9% of offenders on community orders reoffended within a year, or were reconvicted within a year, should I say, down to 2012, that figure had reduced by 6.1 percentage point, which is actually a 15% reduction in proven reoffending over 10 years. Figures for community orders have only been available for the last 8 years. There's been a 2.3 percentage point drop, but that's the equivalent of 6.1% reduction in proven reoffending. Now, I think if the incoming owners of the CRC do half as well as the results under the probation service under the last decade, it will be trumpeted as a massive success. We haven't seen any mention of it in the MOJ press releases, but actually community orders have had a good track record over the last 10 years. All we've heard about is the flatline results for the total. So I think this will be a useful benchmark. It will be interesting to see what happens under transforming rehabilitation and whether the trajectory continues downwards. The second assumption is that it's never been part of probation's duties to supervise under 12-month prisoners. Important that they are supervised, not our fault if the reoffending rates are high. Probation staff have felt really quite exercised by the fact that no serious consideration was ever given about whether this task could have been taken on by probation trusts. It would have been less disruptive, less risky, and goodness knows there are lots of good examples across the country where probation services, community safety partnerships, local authority and police and prison service are developing or had been developing through the GATE schemes. Salas Hadjipavlou, chief executive of PCA, wrote in The Guardian 2 weeks ago, "One cannot help feeling that a huge opportunity has been lost to build on existing effective arrangements delivered by probation trusts that have all been judged by the MOJ as good or excellent and which were never asked if they were able to take on the work. If that option was ever seriously costed and considered, then certainly PCA has never seen it." Probation wasn't a failing organisation, and the National Audit Office in its recent landscape review of probation in March 2014 said, "In general, the probation sector has been performing acceptably." I have to just show this picture again. It's one of my favourites. It's the myself and Siebert Cox from the Probation Association receiving the British Quality Foundation's Gold Medal in 2011, awarded to probation trusts collectively because of our huge commitment to quality. The first time ever that a public sector organisation had been given this medal. So given all of this, given good performance, given the public accolade which probation was given in 2011, wouldn't it have made more sense to ask probation to slim down, take on the new work, build on firm foundations? Well, really, that was never on the cards, was it? Because although the programme might be called Transforming Rehabilitation, actually, it's really about transforming the public sector. The Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, in their 12-13 UK policy review, refer to ourselves and the PA questioning of the rationale for TR and say that, and it's a bit of a long quote, but bear with me, that such institution-specific arguments at times cut little ice with ministers and their advisers, points to the importance of understanding the underlying governmental rationale, of which specific institutional reforms are but so many instances. From this perspective, the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister's emphasis on growing the private sector and reforming the public sector offers an important framework for understanding criminal justice and welfare reforms that, from an institution-specific perspective, can appear to lack clear reasoning. Which is basically a longhand way of saying, however strong our professional arguments, they were never going to change the Minister's mind, because probation reform was just another cog in the wheel of a political ideology based on shrinking the state and bringing in the private sector. The political determination to make this happen has been intense, leading to a pace of implementation which, this is my word, but I think it's been reckless, I think it's been too fast, and I think a price will be paid down the road. Now, I'm not entirely alone on this. Much more reputable bodies have also spoken about their concerns. The Justice Select Committee in January said witnesses, including some supportive of the proposed changes, had significant apprehensions about the scale, architecture, details, and consequences of the reforms and the pace at which the government is seeking to implement them. The Public Accounts Committee in March also expressed their concern about the scale, complexity, and pace of the changes, mentioning MOJ's extremely poor record of contracting out, which gives rise to particular concern. The Public Accounts Committee will be looking at the reforms again later in the year, but they raised issues about payment by results, which they described as complex and untested. The risks they want to look at later in the year are, has there been increased bureaucracy on the interface between the NPS and CRC? Has the short-term prisoner work been properly resourced? Has the design of payment by results been robust enough to avoid gaming by future providers? Has the procurement been managed well? And what contingency planning is there in the event of supplier failure? Well, the splitting up of trusts, as I've mentioned, went ahead on the 1st of June. Not everything was properly in place at that date, not surprisingly, because of the pace at which it's been implemented. From a public safety perspective, the biggest risk actually was the simultaneous move of staff and cases. 240,000 cases, 17,000 staff. Now, it has to be said, the world doesn't seem to have fallen apart in the last 2 weeks, but it's still very early days. We're 2 weeks in, we have yet to see what the impact on performance and public safety will be. All I can say at the moment is it feels very raw. The changes have been driven through in the teeth of opposition from staff, with NAPO having called for strike on two occasions. And although I think it's fair to say a lot of the distress and the anger which we saw in the sort of February-March period has subsided, a common description I hear at the moment is that staff feel flat. I take that to mean that they feel a bit resigned, a bit demotivated. It's going to be a long haul to get the probation service, I think, back up to the point it was in that period pre-TR, where we heard a confident optimism about practice. Now, we know probation staff are used to surviving change. They've had lots of experience of this, and I have no doubt that these good, proud staff will try to make the new arrangements work. It would, however, be foolhardy to ignore the immense toll that it's taken on individuals. There is a real need for positive leadership and honest and full engagement with staff going forward. This, however, is made difficult because we're not done yet. And until the longer-term ownership of the CRCs is settled, uncertainty remains for staff. Will the new CRCs basically just come in and manage the back office and the IT and let the CRCs get on with it? Or will they come in with a whole new offender management system that's been dreamed up somewhere in the ether and be implemented? A lot of staff, particularly back office staff, don't know, will they have a job? A lot of staff still don't know, will the job they have in the future be a job they want to do? Do the embryonic probation mutuals have a real chance in the competition? One of the more high-profile mutuals, which is Kent, Surrey, Sussex, has recently pulled out. Or will contracts be shared out between a small number of large organisations? This isn't helped, of course, because of the high-profile failures we've seen of large private sector companies in the last few months. The referral to the Serious Fraud Office of G4S and Serco for overcharging, as it's put, on their electronic monitoring contracts. The allegations around AFIT-E in relation to the work programme. Serco's poor performance in relation to the out-of-hours GP service for Cornwall. If we look at the prison service, which has more of a track record of privatisation, then it is that there is a more mixed picture. There are, of the 14 contracted out prisons, there are only three companies currently running them: Sodexo Justice Services, Serco Custodial Services, G4S Justice Services. But if you look at NOM's annual performance ratings that were the most recently published, you'll see that the performance on the whole is reasonable for the majority of the private sector prisons. One indeed, that's Park Prison in South Wales, is excellent. But of the three prisons that score the lowest possible rating, two of them are from the private sector, which is disproportionate, and those are Thameside, run by Serco, and Oakwood, run by G4S. Now, the market for prisons is much more developed. That's not the case with the probation service. As we all know, PBR pilots were cancelled when Chris Grayling came into office. Serco dipped their toe in the water with community payback in London. That contract terminates at the end of 2014. So it's inevitable that, with the possible exception of the staff mutuals, any of the new entrants coming in won't have a track record of running community-based probation services. Is there any international experience to draw upon? Well, I'd like to quote from the evidence given to the Public Accounts Committee. 14th of March, Public Accounts Committee, a thoroughly uncomfortable grilling for four senior officials from MOJ NOMS. Chair, brackets, Margaret Hodge, Labour MP for Barking. Is there any international evidence on this payment by results stuff? Antonia Romeo, very little actually. Chair, none, any. Mr. Jackson, brackets, Stuart Jackson, Conservative MP for Peterborough. There is some in the United States, I'm sure. Chair, is there? Antonia Romeo, there are various different models because, of course, in the United States, there are states where probation is provided privately or by the voluntary sector. In terms of an exactly equivalent model, there's not one of which I'm aware, but perhaps we can provide more information to the committee. I'd be interested to see if anything was provided, because I'm not aware of an exactly equivalent model anywhere either. But I think Mr. Jackson probably didn't do MOJ any good in referring to the United States, because I think some of the more shocking examples of what can go wrong if outsourcing is done badly come from the southern United States. There's a growing phenomenon there called offender-funded probation, and one of the leading companies is Judicial Correction Services. And at least a copy of one of their website pages, complete misnomer. It's neither fair, nor is it anything that approximates to probation, although it calls itself that. And if the report by Human Rights Watch is correct, then the services it provides are primarily to serve itself. What it says here if your court is looking for a comprehensive solution to recidivism, Judicial Correction Services has the experience to implement a system of supervision that works for your court. These community-focused enhancements come at no cost to the taxpayer. Later on on the slide, it says the court incurs absolutely no cost for these services. Sounds too good to be true? Well, it is. Offender-funded probation means what it says on the tin. probation funded through the fees which an offender has to pay to be on probation. There's a basic fee for supervision appointments, extra fees for drug testing or electronic monitoring. On the same website, there's guidance for people coming to their appointments, including the fact that they have to give 24 hours notice if they aren't going to turn up or incur an extra fee. There's a requirement that they bring the cash to their supervision session. The report, Profiting from Probation, which is a very salutary read, provides accounts of offenders who may only have committed a minor offence but who cannot pay a fine, and because of that are put on so-called offender-funded probation. They give an example. Thomas Barrett, destitute, living primarily off food stamps, was arrested in 2012 for stealing a can of beer valued at $2 and was sentenced to probation with Sentinel Offender Services, a for-profit firm. Despite selling his own blood plasma twice a week to raise money, Barrett fell more than $1,000 behind in his payments and was jailed for failure to pay. Started off being fined for stealing a $2 can of beer, ended up $1,000 in debt to the probation company. I think what's most shocking from the report is not only how they go about doing their business, but the fact that the courts had no idea. They had no idea how much these companies were charging. They weren't monitoring what was happening to the people who were on the orders. It paints a horrifying picture of what can happen, actually, if a state abdicates responsibility for the services it's supposed to manage. If we come back to the European probation rules, they are neutral on who should provide probation, but they're absolutely clear that the state cannot abdicate responsibility. Now, I don't think something like this would happen in this country, but it provides a really salutary lesson of what can happen if things get out of hand. And to be balanced, I thought I'd look at another example of an outsourced probation service, and this is completely the other end of the scale, and this is in Austria. Now, Austria, really interestingly, has had an outsourced provision since 1999. Neustart, which means new beginning, is a not-for-profit organisation which describes itself as value-driven, and if you look at their website, it certainly comes across like that. We focus on dealing with the causes for criminality instead of deterrence. Our mission, in a nutshell, is, and this is, I think, probably not a great translation from the German, treat the past, manage the present, secure the future. They work not only with offenders, but also with victims, and have a very strong record of victim-offender mediation. Christoph Koss, who's the CEO of Neustart, says, although outsourcing to Neustart was planned as temporary provision, that's back in 1999, until the establishment of a public service, the advantages of a private probation service became apparent soon. And he cites the reasons being the relative independence of the social work practice they can undertake, the opportunity to develop new services and pilot them, the flexibility they have of a quick response to changes, and that they're less costly because public servants in Austria are very expensive. Now, I can see a lot of that will be advantages that CRCs can possibly bring if they pursue their mission ethically, with integrity, and if they take advantage of the opportunities that they have. So these are two examples of what can happen under outsourcing. What's going to happen in this country? Will marketisation be, being gloomy again, the final nail in probation's coffin? But we have to recognise that a marketplace deals in commodities. It's not driven by ethics. It has to survive in a commercially tough environment and by raising profits. Doesn't mean it can't do a good job. Clearly it can. But it's not the role of the private sector to safeguard public values and standards. That is the role of the state. There's a public. If the state chooses not to safeguard certain standards, then they are at risk if there's not any other professional body able to take on that role. And therefore, there is a risk for probation profession, probation identity, as a result of the impending share sale. The first is that the delivery of probation services will be much more fragmented, with up to 30 potential bidders for a total of 21 community rehabilitation companies. Whilst CRCs in the future will have to show how they maintain skills and standards, and I think this is really critical, they're not obliged either to recruit qualified probation officers or use the probation qualification framework. Although I'm pleased to see that probation as a name will be incorporated in the CRC logo, there is no guarantee that staff will keep probation in their job titles. And indeed, this awful term, officer of a provider of probation services, is what's used in the Offender Management Act. In the most extreme case, and it probably won't ever be this extreme, but you could have 21 CRCs all recruiting and training differently. And going back to that NAPO quote, where the culture is carried, we've seen, is largely through the history, the training, the workplace. All of that foundation could potentially be eroded by the fact that there isn't any mandated and integrated professional training and qualification framework. So it's a bit interesting that given that the TR programme, in my view, effectively has undermined the PQF, that the white paper, Transforming Rehabilitation, has given a commitment to professionalisation. And it says, this is the report published last January, we're clear that we will maintain probation expertise and a strong probation profession. All providers in the new market will be required to sustain appropriate skills for these services, with effective training and accreditation comparable to the high standards in place today. Query, why not keep the high standards in place today? But the fact is that the importance of doing so is recognised, even though the PQF hasn't been supported. The question is asked, given we've caused this problem, what's the most appropriate way of ensuring professional standards are maintained and assuring the quality of training and accreditation? So in the midst of all of the change, it's actually been a bit of a ray of light that the idea of an independent probation institute has been endorsed. This is something that the Probation Chiefs Association and indeed the Probation Association have been promoting for years, way before Transforming Rehabilitation came on the scene. But it never really got much buy-in from the Ministry of Justice, although there was support from ministers. Now it's the case that the Probation Institute, as an idea, is embedded in the specification that's gone out to providers. And the most recent version of the specification, the Target Operating Model, version 3, published in May 2014, says of the Institute, it's interesting, describes it as a recognised centre of excellence in probation practice, it don't really exist yet properly, applying rigorous standards to the assessment of research and other evidence and its implication for the delivery of services that protect the public and rehabilitate offenders. It will develop a strong probation profession across private, public and voluntary sectors. What's also significant in the Target Operating Model, have a look if you haven't pored over it before now, it talks about the development of a probation profession being supported through a voluntary register of practitioners, capturing the skills, qualifications and experience of the workforce and supporting continuing professional development, promoting events that contribute to skills growth and knowledge in this area. Now, when we first started talking to MOJ about the idea of a register of probation professionals, by we I mean the PCA, about 3 years ago, there was really not just no buy-in for the idea of an institute, there was no buy-in for the idea of a register of professionals. And even quite recently, when we were talking to ministers about the Probation Institute, there was still hostility to the idea of a register because it was seen potentially as being creating a sort of closed shop, which then might not be able to include ex-offenders service users who were assisting in peer mentoring. things have moved on, and I think it's a bit of a victory that now not only is there no opposition in the centre to the idea of a register, but it's actually enshrined within the target operating model, which means that the bidders for the CRCs will be well aware that that is now expected to be on the books. So in the midst of what I think is a very difficult environment and will be for some time to come, the Probation Institute really does provide an opportunity to regain the profession. The Probation Institute was launched in March of this year as a not-for-profit organisation through a partnership between the Probation Chiefs Association, the Probation Association, NAPO and Unison, a coming together of organisations representing the chiefs, the leadership, the employers, the boards and the staff representative bodies, NAPO and Unison. More importantly, it was launched as an independent institute. And although it's been important to have a dialogue with the Ministry of Justice about the launch of the Institute, we don't, after all, want to be in battle with the Ministry of Justice. We want to be able to work with them. The fact is the Institute is independent and will be independently funded. It's very early days yet, but we're making steady progress. We've got premises. We're working on a governance structure. You heard Lorraine describe me as a temporary member of the board. There will be elections to the board later this year, so we'll be seeking people ready to stand. We've been engaging with key stakeholders about how the Institute should develop, and there's still lots of scope of what it might look like, how it might operate. We're very, very keen to engage with staff, with academics, with policymakers, with the wider interested public. We're holding two professional conferences in June. The first was last Friday in London, was very successful. Lol Burke and Rob Canton both spoke at it, and a lot of very positive feedback on Twitter. The first edition of our magazine is out, called Probation Quarterly. Does what it says, it'll come out quarterly. We've brought copies of the magazine, not enough probably for every member of the audience, but they're outside for you to have a look at. We hope that you find it an interesting and good read, and we hope if you haven't already become a member of the Probation Institute that you consider doing so. There are instructions about how to join both in the magazine and on the website. We've drafted a code of ethics for consultation, and you'll see on the desk in front of you that copies are there. We've been raising these in the professional conferences. They're open for consultation. We do urge you to have a look at this and give us feedback. Consultation is open until the 31st of July. The importance of the code of ethics will be that anyone who joins the Institute in the future will be asked to commit to abiding by the code of ethics. It'll be at the heart of the register. So, very important. As time goes by, we'll also be seeking corporate membership of the Institute, and we'll have an equivalent code of ethics for corporate bodies who might join. I think this is one of the ways in which we hope to safeguard the profession. If CRCs want to join the Institute, they will have to sign up to a code of ethics. So where will we be in 2 years? Oh, sorry, I ought to mention as well the professional register. It doesn't exist yet, but we're in the process of tendering for bids to design it. So anyone in this room, if you're interested, go on our website. We're looking for bids from interested parties who want to help us design how the register will operate and how it can manage continuing professional development going forward. Will we in 2 years? Well, I would hope that the professional register will be up and running, and through this we'll be championing the need for an integrated framework of qualifications and continuing professional development. We want the Institute to be a key player as NOMS comes to review the PQF, which we'll have to do over the next 2 years as the current contracts end by 2016. Through the establishment of professional networks, we want to provide a mechanism that will bring together probation workers, academics, officials, to be able to work together on key professional issues, regardless of which organisation they come from. Now, that's going to be really important after share sale, because there will be a sort of Berlin Wall between the NPS and the CRCs. Once the CRCs are in the private sector, the NPS can't provide things in the way that, that there might be an interchange between CRCs and NPS at the moment. So things like, if there's a probation library or a joint knowledge base, how will that be managed to ensure that both CRC staff and probation staff can access this? These are really important questions. And the Probation Institute, potentially as an honest broker in the middle of all of this, can help to find some of the solutions together with people here in this audience. Through the commissioning of reviews of best practice, we hope to be able to influence policy. Through the commitment of members to a code of ethics, we'll be supporting those important shared values. And through engagement with the employers, we hope to gain support and commitment to the work of the Institute. So, in conclusion, I've called this lecture Why Probation Matters, because probation does matter. It matters to me. I described myself at the start as a Morbian Worrell lifer, and that's absolutely how I feel. I wanted to think about why probation matters for society and the important role it's played in humanising justice. I wanted to think about its ethical heart, how it's survived so far and what it now looks like. I also wanted to think about when probation could stop being probation, and I think offender-funded probation is a good example of what happens when so-called probation loses its purpose in pursuit of profit. I also wanted to consider whether the promising signs which probation had been showing in the run-up to TR would survive the tidal wave which seemed like it might engulf and drown much that we hold dear. And I think Rob Canton was right when he spoke at the Probation Institute conference on Friday, when he talked about now being the time to stand up and be proud of probation. Now isn't the time to throw in the towel. Now is the time to assert what's best about probation and fight to make sure that the profession continues to exist. Society is the richer for an effective probation service. I think Bill McWilliams would have agreed with this. The shared values which underpin the profession remain strong. Confidence in the ability of probation to make a difference is high. I'd also say that despite everything, the standing of probation in local communities also remains high. We've gained huge respect over the last decade through our work with the police and multi-agency partnerships, integrated offender management. I don't doubt for a moment or underestimate how difficult the next year, the next 2 years, the next 3 years are going to be for all probation workers, whether they're in the NPS or the CRCs, or indeed in some other part of the future supply chain. There are risks to service delivery in relation to managing the interface between the NPS and the CRCs, to the competition and the introduction of payment by results, particularly if the procurement process for the CRCs pays more attention to price than it does to quality. However, as we've seen, governments come and go, policies come and go, structures come and go, and indeed people come and go. If we're successful in creating a robust and independent probation institute, then we'll be doing something for probation which is enduring and which can help to promote excellence in practice and a strong professional identity. So to end, despite all of the undoubted challenges ahead, I would have to say, with respect to Mark Twain, that reports of probation's death are still, until proved otherwise, greatly exaggerated. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm member of the Lecture Committee. planning group falls to me at this point very nicely every year to thank the speaker. And we've always been lucky in our choice of speakers. We've usually managed to find the person for the moment. And I certainly think this year you've done us proud. You were definitely the person for this moment. You've given us a very lucid account of what's happening. You've filled in a few details, I think, for some people who maybe weren't fully apprised of that. And appropriately, you've told us what the rays of hope might be, right? And you've exhorted us. You've laid it on us as an obligation, I think, not to give up on probation at what, to many people, undoubtedly seems like the darkest times it's ever faced, because in one sense the worst has happened. So I think we're heartened to hear that you're not going to give up on it, and I'm sure everybody here is going to encourage you very strongly to do the things with the Probation Institute that you've said it is capable of doing. So thank you very much, Sue. I have to give you a present. Long-termers at this event will know that when I gave Rob Morgan his present in a rather darker auditorium than this, he stood up, right, and I stepped back and fell off the stage. So I'm happy that we do it here. It's the health and safety people. We had a word, and it doesn't have to. Thank you very much. Okay.
Oh,
a little
you.
Present
for some
easy
room. Thank you very much.
I'd now like to ask Professor Rob Canton to come and join us at the front. We're having a panel of two. I think maybe if you look up the word panel in a dictionary, it might suggest two's not enough, but with these two, it's going to be. Okay? It's going to be. And the questions this year will be to both people. Sue will answer them, and when Rob thinks he's got something useful to contribute, he will answer as well. I'm sure in one sense, Rob needs no introduction. He's a professor at De Montfort University. He's been a major voice in debates about the future of probation for a long time. I first met him, and I have great memories of this, when we were involved together in probation training in the West Midlands. Rob has had an illustrious career in the probation service before his present academic position, and all of you who know his writing will know that he's a must-read man when it comes to issues to do with probation these days. And his significance to contemporary debates has already been flagged up by Sue in her presentation. So I'm sure you will get wise words from both our panel members, and the floor is now yours.
Okay, thanks.
Lord, yeah.
Thanks.
Just tell us who you are.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Lord Burke, Liverpool John Lodge University, and that's a probation general. Thanks, Sue, for a really stimulating overview. My question is that you talk about, in Race to the Code of Ethics, about what the owners, the providers were silent to, and it seems to be an expectation or a hope that they would do the right thing. But you also highlighted the fact that they have a history of not doing the right thing. And I just wonder, where will that leave the probation system in those circumstances whereby, particularly, you have a large, powerful provider in delivering a number of areas who basically doesn't uphold the code of ethics? Will there be a process for re-registration or any penalty towards those? Because given it's still a very small organisation.
There's a lot to be considered about how we engage with the new owners of the CRCs. But what I would say at the moment is they are coming in without, by and large, a track record of delivering within probation. And for many of them, I think we're aware, they're actually quite worried about how they will be able to meet the requirement in the target operating model that they can train and sustain a group of staff that can deliver. And we know from the work programme that they will start off with their different ways of training the people through their employment advisors, but ultimately chose to start to work together because it made sense to develop training in a more integrated way. So far we've had very positive, I mean, we would have, wouldn't we, at this stage, I think, so far we've had very positive messages coming from the CRCs, because actually there is a two-way benefit for them. By engaging with us, they get a kite mark for their organisation, which helps them in their relationship with the Ministry of Justice. On the other hand, to engage with us, they also have to give guarantees on behalf of their staff. For example, I can imagine that one of the things we'd ask them to sign up to would be about facilitating their staff to continue professional development, giving access to qualifications, supporting the development of an integrated framework of qualifications, releasing staff to go to events. How we would deregister a corporate member who signed up and then didn't live up to the code of ethics, I think is a question that I wouldn't want to sort of jump into at the moment, Lol, because it would be a serious consideration that we would have to give. But I guess I'm an eternal optimist about these things, and I think at the moment the benefits of being part of the Probation Institute will be more apparent to them than being an outsider working on the fringes of probation.
What I'd also say is that
even if the CRC doesn't sign up, there is nothing to stop all the individual members of staff within the CRC becoming members of their own right.
No, by no means. I think we've already finished. I think about the code of ethics. It's something which you can use as a basis for accountability, I think. And that's part of the value of having such a thing in the first place. So at the moment, if a CRC is behaving in a particular way, and it turns around and says, well, we're delivering on our contract, that's the end of the matter. But if they have made that overt and public commitment, then I think it becomes uncomfortable for them to resist the expectations of the Institute, particularly, as you mentioned, Sue, that they will. This could be a valued kite mark. And if CRCs and companies come to be in competition with one another, which presumably is how markets operate, then maybe they wouldn't want to jeopardise that. So it gives a kind of an additional moral authority to buttress the purely contractual requirement that's going to be the bidding.
Hi, I'm actually Mert. I'm like Sue, a lifer in probation. And this is just a bit of a challenge, I think. It's been a slight wake-up call for me when I read the account of Clint's AGM, where the chief exec of the Langkelly Foundation suggested that we shouldn't be nostalgic for the past system that had let down thousands. And what he was referring to were the multi needs of the short-term prisoners. And in my own probation trust, looking at our small project with short-term prisoners and people involved in it, time and time again, these are people that have not been able to be engaged under a community sentence. So I do think there are great challenges for the communities in working, making a step change in how we work. And I'd be really interested in how the Probation Institute, as a real priority, could help the new companies think about the approaches to multi-problem people for whom our current framework doesn't really meet the literature, it doesn't really meet where we need to be.
I'm sort of a lifer, but I kind of was released on license and serving out my time at the university, but I sort of feel I could be recalled at any time. I agree with you about nostalgia, but I find part of this a little bit difficult to hear. Because I remember a time when the probation service was saying, we are really keen to work with short sentence prisoners.
Said it yourself.
Absolutely, and government said, although you can't do that, you have to. And those of us who remember the SNOP, you remember SNOP of 1984, if I'm not mistaken, marginalised that work and said, you can't do that anymore. Yeah. So it's a little bit galling to hear, not from you, but from others, say, oh, well, look at all these people who were left out. But I agree that it would be a bad mistake. I think the Institute should be built on the pride of the achievement of the probation service. But I think it would be a bad mistake for it to keep saying, oh, well, look, if anyone won't mind that in the old days, we've got to try and reinvent the past, because the world is now as it is. It's not the same world in which the 1984 statements and so on were made. So nostalgia, pride in our past, something to build on, but at the same time, I agree on a minimum of nostalgia and the acknowledgement of the needs, that the persistent need to do things better by particular vulnerable groups.
Maxine, I agree with you that we need to engage with short-term prisoners. I'm not sure about the use of the term let down. Many of these people in short-term, on short-term sentences, are the people in the revolving door syndrome, you know, that we see time and time again. And the fact that they're in prison doesn't mean that there's been failure. We all know that coming out of a life of crime takes time. And if you're in that sort of social context where you're heavily involved, at some point you may well end up doing a short-term prison sentence. One of the reasons that integrated offender management schemes have really embraced the idea of through the gate, or has embraced the idea of through the gate schemes, is because many of the nominals in integrated offender management schemes were also the people who then went into custody and came out time and time again. And what we found through our through the gate scheme in Leeds Prison is that if you do engage with prisoners when they're inside, even on short-term sentences, if you do provide them with assistance and support in relation to accommodation, access to benefits, which is often a critical issue, access to drug treatment, then you can help interrupt their immediate sort of moving back into further reoffending. So I don't think they're any different to the groups of people that we deal with on community orders, and I don't think it's fair to say community orders have necessarily failed them. They may have reached the end of the road before they, in terms of what sentencing options are, but they may be people who are still ripe to come out and move into a journey towards desistance from crime.
Okay.
Yeah. Next is the PSO case manager, also an Apple branch chair. Question on training. I love Sue's optimism about training, but aren't we in danger with only allowing the non-recruiting, only graduate entries at the moment, of a grading gap similar to the Howard gap of some time ago? And won't that then potentially lead to a blurring of role boundaries when CRCs can't employ probation officers because there aren't enough?
I don't actually defend the way that the current entry to the PQF has been designed. I haven't for some time because I think it's too... The basis on which people have been recruited in has been too narrow. So until recently, you've either had to be a PSO or you've had to have a relevance degree. So people like me would never nowadays get into the probation service. I think we really need to think again in access to qualification, how we recruit in a way that is truly open and brings in fresh blood. And I would hope that in the review of the PQF, which is going to have to happen over the next 2 years, that can be addressed. I do think, actually, it's one of the... I talked about the NOMS, MOJ, and for the Home Office, having had a really tight grip on entry to the profession. And I actually much preferred it as it was under Diploma in Social Work at the CQSW before that. Dependent Probation Studies, sorry, work, Dependent Social Work, whatever it was, Probation Studies, DIPS, where actually you could apply the actual ability, the eligibility to apply was much wider than it is at the moment. So I would hope that we could expand the basis. And I think you're right. I'm not really sure about the issue about blurring the boundaries, but I do think that there isn't enough consideration being given at the moment to how many qualified probation officers will need in the future. And that's hugely muddied by the fact that the CRCs aren't required to recruit qualified probation officers. So really hard to do workforce planning on that basis. It's something that does need to be addressed.
I was a big fan of the Diploma in Probation Studies. It's something I was very proud to be associated with. I think it was excellent, but a fair criticism that was levelled at it towards the end was that it was just available for probation officers, and other staff working within the probation areas and trusts were relatively neglected. And I think that's a perfectly fair criticism. I mean, as for the blurring of boundaries, there'll be people in this audience who know much better than I do But I've been worried for some time that that's already taking place, that under the pressure of significant caseload sizes, it's been quite hard for some of those older role boundaries to be held onto in any event. So I don't know whether I'm sure that the arrival of the CRCs and the introduction of people whose primary priority is profit making will, one of the ways in which they'll look to save money, I think, is by having staff who are not as highly trained. But what I'm not sure about is whether that is exacerbating a current trend or creating a new problem.
Okay.
I'm Martin Corson, a probation officer in Leicester. So you gave a quote about when we lost social work qualification, the last claim to an identity defined outside government policy. And it's interesting that maybe the Probation Institute may be trying to reassert that sort of claim. Also, Rob, you spoke at the PCA conference and said that when probation is ostentatiously stationed, kicking social work out of the front door, it was also sneaking in the back door. And on that note of forming that identity, and having pride in the past, is it time that probation overtly reconnects with its history, the theory and practice of social work?
It's a great question. I like the question very much. I think that Sue was quoting some work done by Gwen Robinson and Fergus McNeil, and it's a terribly important point. There was a time when somebody said, this is all very precious, probation is what probation staff do. And there was no independent definition apart from that. I think that was part of the point that Gwen and Fergus made so eloquently in those days. When Sue was talking earlier about how the workplace and history and the culture, one of the things that makes me feel a little bit more optimistic is I think it's also some of the values of probation, I think, inevitably arise out of doing the work in a principled way. So you can say, oh, right, look, I'm going to punish people. But if somebody comes along onto your office and you say, right now, you're here to be, you know, you'll either get thumped or you'll never see them again, or maybe both. So treating people with decency and encouragement and kindness and patience and tolerance and all those good things, I think you emerge directly from doing the job in a principled way. I can't imagine doing the job of probation in any other way than that. Now, whether we want to call that social work, is maybe, for me, not ever so important. But Peter Rayner, who gave this lecture a few years ago, he once said that it's time that we grew out of this nonsense of saying, oh, well, probation isn't social work, so probation has got nothing to learn from social work. Of course probation is social work, and in many countries, they're very confident and relaxed about that. Social work has to work with difficult people in difficult circumstances, ask of them things that they wouldn't necessarily choose to do on their own. And that, I think, circumscribes what they can do. And I think probation confronts exactly the same difficulty. So I hope that we've rather outgrown that silly stuff about what we can't be social
with. I think it is a good question. In Scotland, they still train people working in community justice or criminal justice as social workers. In Northern Ireland, they still maintain that. In Ireland, they still maintained it. And indeed, in most parts of Europe, there is no distinction between the training that people working in criminal justice do to the training that people do who work in social work. And indeed, my son's a social worker who works in child protection, and when I see his practice and the way he has to work with parents and children, the sort of difficulty of that sort of work is not a million miles from the difficulty of some of the work that probation staff have to do. Where I think CQSW failed, or certainly failed me, was that it was too much geared to the work of local authority social workers and wasn't sufficiently cognizant of the specific needs that you need if you're going to work in a criminal justice setting. And in that sense, it was useful. It was a good thing to have a much more specific training. But I myself do wonder whether the circle has come, whether we've come full circle, and whether there's time to rethink actually whether or not For example, you know, could you see down the road the probation register becoming part of a wider social care register in the same way that social workers and health professionals are part of the same register? Or will we always have a separate register of professionals? There would be a lot to be said, I think, for reviewing whether or not we need close ties with social work qualification.
Just a quick addition, sorry, but just a very quick one. One way of understanding the professional training curriculum is through knowledge, skills and values. I think that there is some knowledge that social workers need, that probation staff need less.
Yes,
and some knowledge that probation staff need that they don't need as much. I don't know what the differences in skills are. There may be some people who can tell me some differences, but it's not clear to me. And personally, I don't think there's any difference in the values.
I might question me for a specialised training. But currently, it's not even a relevant degree. It's treated as irrelevant, essentially. And what I'm suggesting is that probationists do maybe to consider the relevance of social work, given the huge amount of
I absolutely, totally agree with that point. I think the so-called relevant degrees are far too narrow. And I also, yeah, I look with slight amazement on the fact that all of those colleagues of mine that went off to CAFCAS when CAFCAS split from the probation service, they can now no longer come back and work in probation, and we can't go and work in CAFCAS.
Okay. Now there's lots of hands going up now. There was a hand at the back. Okay, maybe not. In which case, Steve?
Steve Cox, another retired lifer.
Can you speak up, Alexis?
I'm sorry. can I ask you to think about the future context of probation practice and just pick up on a term and phrase you used, Sue, about the shrinking state, and I wonder whether the busy state is better than the shrinking state, because it seems to me that whilst we've been divested of massive supportive services, actually what we've got is we've got a bureaucratic mechanism for controlling the vast resources that are being given to the private sector. Secondly, we've got much more intrusion into the lives of all of us. Thirdly, we've got increasing intrusion into the lives of offenders, and it makes me think about Stan Cohen's old comments about penetration and coverage of the offender networks. And finally, we've got this creeping conditional welfare, and the two obvious ones are troubled families and the works programme, where you don't get anything for anything these days. And it seems to me that the environment for the future of probation practice is so much harsher than perhaps it was for our generation.
It's so interesting you should mention Stan Cohen, because I've written his name down here. One of the first names I wrote out when I was listening to Sue was Stan Cohen. And one of the things that I recall him saying is that you can't really roll back. The state never succeeds in rolling itself back. It says that it's going to roll itself back, but in the process of so doing, it actually becomes ever more intrusive. So I think you're right to say that although the government rhetoric says less state, in fact it's a different kind of state, and it's a very active and busy thing. The other thing he's reminded us of, or one of the many wise things that Stan Cohen said, was to distinguish between the stories that policymakers tell about what they are doing and the lived reality of that. So inevitably when we reflect on probation, we focus on change, but very often the changes that we're discussing are changes in the story rather than the lived reality. And I think it would be quite interesting to ask people who were recipients of probation services 15, 5, 10 years ago, and maybe in 2 years' time, how much difference they've actually noticed. So there's been this radical change that Sue has spoken about, terribly early days, but it's the same people coming to see the same stuff with just the same position that they were in before. So what they make of that change, I don't know. And I haven't answered the question at all, but I'm giving Sue a time and opportunity to think about that.
It's a horrible question, Steve. I'm describing an environment which is getting much, much tougher for all of the people that probation works with, and that would have been the case whether transforming rehabilitation has happened or not. I don't think that affects actually the quality of work that, that probation does with the people that they engage with. It certainly affects the resources that they can tap into. And I suppose one of the things I regret about transforming rehabilitation is that if it hadn't happened, where we were was with the notion of a commissioning trust that would have had more ability to commission resources within the locality, which would have played quite well with the police and crime commissioner agenda. And I could have foreseen that there might have been an environment where we might have been able to make more of the resources which we have available. But that possibility has been, by and large, cut off at the moment from us. But that, I don't think it necessarily affects the quality of the work that will be done. I do think it makes it much tougher for people going forward. And will the Probation Institute be able to do anything about that? I don't know necessarily that it will, Steve.
Okay, John?
Thank you. John Crawford, another former retired, currently semi-retired Chief Member of the Sentencing Council. Thanks for a terrific lecture, Sue. My questions are on a different tack, I think, from the earlier ones. I think one of the things you can observe is that organisations in turmoil can become very internally preoccupied with their own concerns, their cultures, their principles, their ethics, and so on. While I thought that may be very necessary, one of the potential risks is that they lose touch with the public they serve, with victims, with offenders in our case, the offender voice, and also, critically, from my point of view, with the courts from whom the work continues to flow. So my question is that a risk for probation now? And if so, how can we avoid it?
And the answer is it most certainly is a risk for probation now. And I think it will be for some time to come. And it's a risk that has a number of facets. And one is people are genuinely having to be internally preoccupied because people are 2 weeks into a new role. They've got potentially an IT system that's not working properly. The whole way that count cases move between the NHS and CRCs, that's really working its way through the whole thing about risk escalation and how that will work in practice. These are all very, very new things for people in the NPS and CRCs. So there will be a lot of just trying to get an understanding of how best to operate in a new environment. That's inevitable. And indeed, in the National Probation Service, I think the infrastructure is far less developed than it needs to be, if I can put it like that. There's a lot more to happen to support the NPS than has happened at the moment. So that is a risk, but I think the other really sort of problematic risk is whereas previously it was often clear who you needed to talk to get a decision made or influence something, that's suddenly become much more complicated. So whilst in many cases it'll be clear whether it's an NPS or a CRC representative who should be liaising with, in some cases it's both. If I think about West Yorkshire, my trust, whilst there's a new CEO for the community rehabilitation company, there are three local delivery units in West Yorkshire. There is no West Yorkshire lead for the NPS because those three delivery units are three of 22 within the North East NPS division. And there is no one spokesperson now for the NPS around West Yorkshire. So who does the Police and Crime Commissioner talk to if they need to talk to the NPS? Who do the sentencers talk to? I'm no doubt that there'll be lead ACOs identified. But the whole way that we engage with external stakeholders has become much more complicated, and I honestly think there'll be quite a lot of confusion before that settles down. I don't know what the experience is for service users. In many cases, they'll have a new offender manager. They'll be going to the same building, they'll have a new offender manager. Their new offender manager might actually be having to cope with a whole new influx of new cases. So it would be amazing if there were consequences. And I honestly think it'll take the best part of a year, 18 months, for things to begin to, well, actually post-share sale, other than now, post-share sale for things to begin to settle down.
Yeah, I've really not much to add to that, except that I've thought that maybe even a longer time scale, yes, because in a sense this is a false sunset, isn't it? Because many, in many cases I think it is the same staff with the same skills. They know each other, the people will be dealing with one another, they have trust and confidence in each other. Over time that will begin to change, and at that point I think that rub will be felt particularly.
Okay.
Anne Hyde, Leicester and Rutland Probation Trust board member. Continuing the sentencing thing, well, I've had various sentences and now I've lost my sentence and I regret that. Sue, you mentioned that Kent had, I think you used the expression, pulled out of their staff mutual. And I'm wondering whether they pulled out or whether they were in fact driven out. And as it's a subject close to my heart, I just wonder what you feel about the future, if any, of staff mutuals. It seems to me particularly ironic that some of us, had cabinet support to set such things up and then had no choice in continuing their development, at least for the time being.
Are you in a position where you're in from a staff mutual that's had to cease, or is that what you're saying? Or
my trust is in that position.
Right. Okay. Yes. I actually don't know the inside story to Ken Surrey Sussex. I only know that their planned development isn't going ahead. And I was very surprised in many ways. I think it was probably to do with their partners. Because Ken had been the most high profile of potential staff mutuals, and the only one where a chief executive had chief executive of the CRC had elected to stay with the mutual development team until after the bid had been put in. But there are still a number of staff mutuals that are very actively developing, and Maxine in front of you, who's involved in a staff mutual, and indeed in my own trust, we've got a very sort of boisterous and enthusiastic staff mutual that has also received cabinet funding. It's very hard to get the inside story on any of this at the moment. The mutuals are developing behind ethical walls. And you don't necessarily know at the moment who's still in the business, who's still got a partner, who's still in the bidding for what. So we'll have to see what comes through. I'd be really disappointed if no staff mutuals at all succeed in gaining a contract. Given particularly that the Cabinet Office has, I think, been quite positive, or been very positive in supporting Probation Trusts and trying to set up mutuals, probably in the teeth of opposition, I suspect, from within MOJ in some instances. But I would like to think that at least one staff mutual will be optimist.
Okay, we've got potentially the two last questions, depending on how short your questions are, and how quick they answer. Terry Morley.
Terry Crowley, formerly head of research in the Merseyside Probation Service almost 20 years ago. I'm very interested to see that you, in your constitution, the new Probation Institute, you're going to apply rigorous standards of assessments, and I'm very delighted to hear that. But I also know from experience that it's very difficult to get research findings into the public domain and eventually into public policy. And I hope that the Probation Institute has got a strategy to enable that to happen. And I'd be very interested to know what that is. The other two minor points that I want to make is, first of all, who will do that research? Do you envisage that you'll have a partnership with academic institutions? And if so, what do you think the focus of that research should be?
I think I'm going to be a bit naughty here and ask a member of the audience to answer that one. Stavas knows this is going. Stavas, who's the interim chief executive of the of the Institute has been meeting, recently had a meeting with a focus group of academics that I wasn't at, so I think, Savas, can you, very briefly...
Yes, thank you. the short answer is that the Institute itself obviously won't be doing research, and it's not a research organisation. What it ought to do, what it tried to do, it would be to bridge the gap between research and practice, to kind of create that link. So what we are hoping to do is over the next 18 months to commission some reviews that precisely do that. We're working with a network of academics, many of whom are in this audience today. We've had a meeting, we've kind of worked out an agenda of the things that we're going to do over the next 18 months. The next step would be really to articulate what you rightly said is how do we rigorously assess what sort of evidence do we include and so forth. And really a list of high priority four or five topics that are, in a sense, touch on what is urgent and current, but also enduring in terms of practice. And some things that occur to me, for example, I think were mentioned earlier on, how does probation work with its partner organisation? Because many of the problems aren't just our standard. many of the problems do require a lot of health and social intervention. It isn't just an justice intervention. Another one might be around risk assessment, which obviously is going to play across both organisations, both the public sector and the contracted sector. But we will be consulting on some of those topics. So we want to identify some really good half dozen topics that would be relevant in making impact.
Can I make two quick points? One is that I owe to Paul Senior the helpful expression that practice is rarely evidence-led, but should be evidence-informed. There are a lot of things going into the making of policy, and evidence is just one component of that, and maybe rightly so. I do worry that in our area, evidence is so contested, so difficult to interpret, that people take their decisions and then go looking for evidence to support it. And it seems to me that a lot of policy is falling that way. A particular area that I work in, so I've asked within the Institute, is a closer association with the user voice organisations, who are telling us ever more useful things, more instructive things about what the experience of being on probation is actually like. And I'd welcome further development of that kind of inquiry, among other things, of course.
Okay, last question.
Yeah, I was just, sorry, Morgan, I'm from the probation officer. Related in your conclusions, you said that whilst you felt it's kind of a dark day in some senses, there's definitely guys to kind of improve that through sort of Probation Institute and other means. I was wondering then, you went on to say that people, processes, governments change. My take on it is slightly different. I don't think that white classes community justice will get brighter until certain players are out of government. As I say, directly, the Lord Chancellor, the first Lord Chancellor with no legal training, and who's got a track record of decimating welfare to work and now decimating probation. I'm not expecting you to agree with it, but was that a coded message?
Well, I think governments do come and go. With a general election coming up next year. You only have to look at the history of probation over the last 15 years to see how ideas have come and gone and structures have come and gone. And TR2 may pass, or it may change into a different form. I don't think that where we are now is necessarily how it will look, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. And as such, I think we have a responsibility not to give up on probation, but actually we can't stop the split happening. The split has happened, we can't probably stop the procurement happening, the procurement will happen. But within that, we want to make what happens, or wherever the structure goes, we want to make sure that actually the work that's done within that structure reflects the best and highest standards of probation practice. And as such, the Probation Institute isn't wedded to a particular structure or a particular set of policies. It it's about best professional practice. So I do hear what you say. We'll have to wait and see what the future brings. But it won't always be today. It will change.
Change is inevitable, isn't it? But there's also continuities, and we shouldn't forget that, as I understand it, the harvest now is the result of the seeds sown by the Offender Management Act under the Labour administration. This is just the fulfilment, really, of that particular vision. And there are some strong continuities. I couldn't help but chuckle when Sue put up a slide saying that Jeremy Wright claiming to be widely consulted. And I once heard Professor Nellis say a few years ago that New Labour's idea of consultation was to tell people your policy twice. And it still feels like that.
Yeah.
So the personnel will change, but the trajectory, I think, is you know, there's a lot of continuity in that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Rob. Thank you for much. For the older generation of people here, nobody did more than Bill McWilliams to create a sense of what the probation ideal was and why it mattered. I think Sue, aided by Rob, has reminded us as to why it's important, to why it should be kept alive, given us some pointers as to how it might be kept alive. But as you leave here today, I want you to think about the ways in which you might keep it alive in the workplace in which you find yourself. And if you have any ideas as to how the McWilliams lecture could keep it alive, we gave you a form at the beginning, right? A pro forma to kind of fill in with your thoughts about the future of this lecture. So we really are keen that you fill those in, and while you're out there having a cup of tea and having something else to eat, if you leave those forms with any of us who you know happen to be associated with the committee, give them to Rob, give them to me, give them to Lorraine, give them to Brendan and John. Right? So we really would like you to fill them in and leave them with us. And lastly though, I'm glad to come in, Joanna, who makes this possible, year in, year out. We couldn't do it without her. Sometimes she goes back, she sneaks back to the Institute, but today she's coming, so you come down here, Joanna. Everybody else. Without Joanne, we really couldn't get this organised, and you've done it for a long while now. I really appreciate it, and love it and work with you. Thanks very much. So, as you leave here today, what are you going to do about keeping the probation ideal alive, and what are you going to tell us about how the McWilliams lecture might be used up? See you again. Thank you.